and I open an information meeting on healthcare reform. We've got two speakers. They have two different perspectives. I'm going to ask them each to take about 20 minutes for their perspectives, and we'll spend then some time with questions of the committee. So if I may first call Sally Pipes, President and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you.
If you please introduce yourself to the committee.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sally Pipes, and I'm president and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute, a public policy institute based in San Francisco, California. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to give my thoughts on healthcare reform at the state level. I am an economist, recently a Canadian economist, who has studied healthcare systems my entire professional life. As a former Canadian and as an American, I became an American on December 15th of last year, so I'm very excited to be an American now. I have very much experience with how government-financed healthcare works in practice. As an economist, I'm trained to examine incentives, take a full view of costs, not just monetary costs, and be very skeptical of claims that efficiency can be maximized by substituting public and political decision-making and administration for private transactions. I'm going to provide a quick summary analysis of each bill, commenting on what can be known about the provisions. I'm then going to step back and examine the broader issues of healthcare reform and highlight the experiences of Massachusetts, of which much has been written and equally much has been omitted. SB 27. My reading of this bill is that its intent is to establish the framework for a single-payer healthcare system, a Medicare or Medicaid model for all. It is perhaps most ambitious and the least likely to be passed. At its core, it seeks to roll Medicare and Medicaid money into a state-run bureaucratic system that has explicit rationing. It explicitly calls for a centrally planned allocation of healthcare resources. It would destroy the private insurance market with guaranteed issue insurance on all plans, not just small group plans with 50 or under employees. This would have the very effect of raising premiums so that healthy people would drop insurance. It appears to grant general taxing powers to the newly created bureaucracy, the Oregon Health Fund Board. It is generally unwise policy to provide individuals with the power to tax other individuals to support the former individuals' livelihoods. SB 329, like the previous bill, it places faith to design and run a significant portion of the state's economy in a newly created health bureaucracy. It's going to suffer all the same problems. In addition, it calls for explicit government setting of prices. It establishes unattainable goals, ensuring that the costs of health care in this state are shared proportionally and equitably by the state, employers, health care providers, and individuals. How are these players even defined? How is the state separate from taxpayers and individuals? How is it that producers share in costs other than accepting diminished revenues? In addition, the bill mandates that individuals buy into the plan under penalty of losing a tax exemption. This is an individual mandate. It puts the board in direct charge of regulating the day-to-day practices of health plans, Section 13.2. HB 3368. It is unclear to me exactly what is gained by this bill other than the creation of a new government bureaucracy, the Health Insurance Exchange, that will do little to generate little that a general insurance agency functioning under sensible regulations would do in the private health market. It appears to be merely a means to collect new taxes. It has a general power to tax, as outlined in Section 3.3, the Health Insurance Exchange Corporation may establish, impose, collect, and use fees and other mechanisms to ensure sustainable and internally generated funding. I reiterate my previous comment about the danger of granting bureaucracies and hence bureaucrats blanket powers to tax others to support themselves. It contains other job-killing taxes as well. It does appear to extract 2% of payroll from employers. Not that this won't simply be passed on to employees in lower wages or jobs. It will also have the impact of causing employers who are mobile to leave the state of Oregon, and I think that that's the last thing you need at this point in Oregon's business climate. It then also taxes employees on their reduced wages at a rate of 2.8%. Having taxed employers...
Wait a moment. Y'all hear that sound? That's somebody's cell phone going off. So I would appreciate it if you shut off your cell phones, not just silence them, so we can record the proceedings. Excuse me.
Yes. Having taxed employers and employees, it would then fine employees if they don't purchase insurance, yet another tax that simply appears to be a mandate. This cannot be good medicine for Oregon's economy. HB 3341, like the previous bill, the purpose appears to be to create a new government bureaucracy to be a health insurance brokerage. It suffers from the general taxing power, regulation of price and plan design, and the drawback of guaranteed issue and what that tends to do to insurance premiums. Each of the bills under discussion today would establish a larger role for government in the provision of health care in this state. I must also note that for the vast powers that they grant, they are not very detailed. That is, they leave extreme amounts of discretion up to the boards that they create. I would encourage you, the elected officials, to examine the scope and costs of the decisions you will be asking these boards to make. At least two of the four, and almost certainly any solution that comes to passage, would compel residents to purchase some state-mandated health insurance package. In other words, they would create new programs and finance these programs with new taxes. Calling it an individual or an employer mandate to purchase insurance sounds better, but at the end of the day, it is a tax, a compulsory transfer of money from an individual to fund something he or she may not find of value. Taken as a group, I must sadly concede that these plans represent the latest thinking in public policy healthcare circles, among those on the center-left, the far-left, and even several Republicans, such as Governors Romney and Schwarzenegger, the current governor of California. They follow, at least in outline, some successful and some unsuccessful attempts at passing reform at the state level. SB 27 and 329 follow in a proud, if doomed, lineage of bringing a comprehensive, compulsory, and ideally, at least in the view of many advocates, a monopoly system of government health care financing. These systems are very attractive in the abstract. Who wouldn't want to simply pay a tax and have the best health care available for them, all without the profits and overhead expense of private companies? When examined closely, however, they always fail under the harsh light of political debate. Most people, it turns out, are quite satisfied with their health care plan, and they feel they pay enough in taxes. They are rightfully dubious of claims of government efficiency. They understand they often get substandard products from the public sector. Government schools compared to private schools, the United States Post Office compared to Federal Express. And they suspect they will end up on the wrong end of a rationing decision. These fears are legitimate and borne out in experience. It is an innovation of the Oregon political body to confront these realities honestly. You know that resources are scarce and that when something of value like health care is free at the point of consumption, that there will be unlimited demand. Queues will form, funding will be exhausted, and people will suffer. This is the case in my former homeland country, Canada, where we have a single-payer, government-run-only healthcare system with long waiting lists, ration care, and a lack of technological equipment. Canadians today wait on average 17.7 weeks over 4 months from seeing a primary care doctor to getting treatment by a specialist. The Oregon experience will also create a rational rationing list, if I may call it that, and it's also instructive. While intentions were sound, there is rarely a consensus on what is appropriate care. Cost-benefit analysis can be done in the political sphere without actually considering full costs, and if lists appear to discriminate against protected groups, the disabled, either by virtue of chronic intoxication or inability to conceive, the federal government will withhold its consent, as by definition it feels protective of its very protected classes. Such Medicaid for All expansions are therefore not practical. They make promises that can't be kept, as the federal government will not likely roll all of its funding, including that for seniors in Medicare, who do, by the way, now have many choices between public and private plans, into an annual check to subsidize an explicit rationing scheme. There is, after all, no real cost containment in these plans other than controlling budgets and prices paid to providers, which is to say, price controls. Government-set price controls in Medicaid and Medicare are already serious problems in the medical provider community. These systems reimburse, on average, a respective 92 cents and 95 cents for each dollar of care provided. This is the reason why several doctors today are declining to take Medicare and Medicaid patients. Much is made of the supposed costs the uninsured foist on the healthcare system. Yet, as a total cross-subsidy, it doesn't come close to the bill the government sector hands private payers. The other bills represent the cutting edge of a new healthcare consensus that the problem of the uninsured can be solved by mandating that they simply purchase health insurance. It is a compelling theory, especially for those in the business of addressing problems, by telling people what they ought or must do. It won't, however, work. The example often used is that of automobile insurance, which is mandatory in all but three states for anyone who wishes to drive a car. It's required to protect society from the cost of individuals being uninsured. It's all nice and neat, except for the facts. 25% of drivers in California don't have insurance, even though it's mandated, even though they face penalties for not doing so. The law is so ineffective at protecting innocent drivers that most people in California choose to pay extra on their own insurance for provisions that protect against the under and uninsured. The reason that people don't purchase auto insurance is either because they don't want it, they think it's too expensive, or they think there's no value in it, and they think they're not going to be in an accident. Forcing people to purchase something they don't want on threat of fine diminishes their welfare and will upset them, a strange result for elected politicians to be seeking. Massachusetts was the first state to pass such a law nearly a year ago, in April of 2006. California and many other states are following suit, not the least because of the lavish praise Governor Mitt Romney earned in the press and the uncritical examination the program received. The original promise was that universal coverage could be achieved without a tax increase, without an employer mandate, but by reallocating $1 billion the state had already spent on uncompensated care, those people who turn up at emergency rooms. Providing a centralized location for people to purchase standardized plans and to purchase them with pre-tax dollars and relax mandates on plans for young adults. It must be noted that Massachusetts is perhaps the ideal state for such a scheme to work. It has a relatively small uninsured population, about 10% of the population compared to 19% in California and about 14-15% here. A high level of existing subsidy to be redistributed, and a large number of uninsured who were, in fact, eligible for government insurance but just hadn't signed up or could afford it but chose not to purchase it. Today, of the 44 million Americans who are uninsured, 14.8 million of them are people who are eligible for Medicaid or SCHIP or Healthy Families who have not signed up for it. The idea in Massachusetts was to subsidize private insurance not actual care. And those who could afford to pay ought to. Then Governor Mitt Romney and legislative colleagues promised affordable plans in the premium range of $200 a month for people. Critics of the plan argued that the problem in Massachusetts was an overregulated healthcare sector. Guaranteed issue and modified community rating, guaranteed issue meaning that if you don't have insurance and you become ill, the insurer has to provide you with insurance, and community rating at the same rate charged to anyone regardless of age, sex, pre-existing condition, and those things. Many of the young didn't buy the insurance because it was a bad bet. The solution was to deregulate insurance markets, not build more bureaucracy and tighter regulations. We predicted that the new bureaucracy, the Commonwealth Connector, would be a de facto regulator and designer of health plans in Massachusetts, as they set the standards for the plans that individuals must purchase or face fines. We argued that cost estimates were far too low, since in Massachusetts, private insurance costs $10,126 for a family plan and $5,257 for an individual. It was unrealistic to predict that similar plans could be developed for $200 a month. Examining that data, we also challenged the notion that the young, healthy, and uninsured were foisting the majority of costs onto the system. It is clear that only 6% of spending from the uncompensated care went to individuals living in families with incomes greater than 200% of the poverty level. Only 14% went to individuals ages 19 to 24. 71% went to people earning less than $12,728 a year. 42% went to people with no income at all. These are individuals who are not going to purchase insurance upon the threat of losing a tax deduction or paying a fine. As a side note, it is not the uninsured, but rather Medicaid recipients who are disproportionate users of expensive emergency room services instead of less expensive doctor visits or visits to ready clinics such as there exists now in Walmart and Target stores. We also predicted that since many of the plans won't be in fact affordable for many families, politicians will be forced to increase taxes and subsidies and will not in fact have the will to enforce the mandate. Instead, they will blame private insurers for failing to achieve the impossible, provide a $5,257 service for $2,400 a year, and further regulate and control prices. So what has happened so far in Massachusetts? The first thing was the establishment of the Commonwealth Connector Board and its bureaucracy. True to form, it staffed up and paid well, adding many six-figure jobs to the government payroll. The Romney administration reported expected costs in a Wall Street bond filing, which made it clear why political consensus was achieved among providers, politicians, and health advocates. Costs, it turned out, were not the $125 million guaranteed by Mr. Romney and explained to voters in the press, but rather $276 million, an increase of $151 million over what was previously agreed to. More instructive, the plan provided $386 million for rate increases for hospitals, physicians, and managed care organizations. The connector then went to work creating, fully and partially subsidizing plans. Enrollment is less than 100%, and activists have complained that premiums for these plans are too high. The lowest premiums for these subsidized plans start at $18 a month and end at $106 per person, or roughly 4.3% of income for just the insurance. Advocates maintain that these premiums are unaffordable, and therefore the individual mandate and its accompanying fine of half of the premium should not apply to this group. In February of this year, the Commonwealth Connector Board released the premiums for the unsubsidized plans, the ones that the non-poor uninsured would have to purchase or face fines. Although the campaign for passage claim premiums of $200 a month were likely, the plan started out at $380 a month, almost double what they had been guaranteed. The connector board sent the plans back to the design room and the new governor, Deval Patrick, and the next round has found premiums more reasonable. The cheapest plan, which provides care at a network of local clinics and facilities, is $156 a month for a person between the ages of 35 and 39, the average range age of the uninsured. As we predicted, the Commonwealth Connector Board has become the de facto design center for all health insurance in Massachusetts, as its definition of minimal creditable coverage determines whether individuals are fined or not. Currently, in Massachusetts, there are 250,000 people with health insurance that isn't generous enough to meet this test. They will have to change their plans or face fines. It is still too early, and we don't have results on how many of the uninsured will actually commit a significant portion of their income to insurance. I predict it will be far short of the target, that costs will increase, quality will degrade, politicians and bureaucrats will blame the private plans working within the confines of the government's design, and the next step will be further regulation and price controls. And we know those are bad for everyone's health. The things that I would recommend that you look at are reducing mandates and regulations. Oregon has about 32 mandates on its insurance. Allow people to buy the type of insurance plan that fits their needs. If you're a young man of 35, 32, you know, why should you have to buy an insurance plan that has so many mandates and regulations? Because those add to the cost. Guaranteed issue, community rating, add to cost. Why don't you open up the market for ready clinics, mini clinics, reduce the doctor-nurse practitioner ratio, because it's much cheaper for people who are uninsured, low-income people, when they're shopping at Target or Walmart and their child has an earache, to go to a mini clinic than to turn up at an expensive emergency room. You should change the tax treatment for health savings accounts so that individuals can write off the premium from their income tax. I think you should look at certificate of need and not go down the path of certificate of need. In our book, What the States Can Do to Reform Healthcare, certificate of need is a bureaucratic means of not allowing new entrants into the market, and I think it's bad for everyone. I think you should look at reforming medical malpractice, because medical malpractice adds a lot of cost to healthcare premiums, and we need to make reforms in that area. So there's a lot that can be done to open up the market to provide accessible, affordable, and quality healthcare without going down the path of connector boards, special funds, and government bureaucracy, which is not going to solve the problem of the uninsured, and you're going to move down the path to why not have a single-payer system such as exists in Canada. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If I can ask Ms. Leibowitz to join us. Yeah, and I was going to hold questions. We'll hear both presentations, then we'll ask both of the panelists to come up and we'll have questions.
Should I stay here?
You can or not.
Oh, well, maybe I should come back then.
Nora? Uh-oh. You brought along the sheriff.
It was for her request. For the record, my name is Nora Leibowitz. I work for Office of Health Policy and Research, the Oregon Health Policy Commission.
And for the record, this is Janine Smith, Administrator for the Office of Health Policy, and I came along because Nora asked me to, and with the permission of the chair.
I decided that rather than bring 15 stacks of paper, I would just bring the information that is inside Janine's head.
I need to note, we just heard a presentation by an economist. Now we're going to hear a presentation from somebody who was raised by an economist.
Yes, raised by an economist.
It's almost as bad.
Probably. Maybe worse. I learned that life is all about choice. Whether that's, you know, good or bad. So I was asked to... Yes. I was asked to come and talk some about what some states across the country are doing with regard to health reform, and You've heard some about Massachusetts. I'm going to talk in front of you. You have a table that has Massachusetts, Vermont, Maine, and California's governor's proposal. I'm going to talk some about the one that people tend to be really interested in is Massachusetts. I know California has gotten some attention, but I also wanted to bring in Vermont and Maine, as they have slightly different, sort of similar paths, but some different decisions. So one of the things that's come up a lot is the issue of the individual mandate. And as was mentioned by Ms. Pipes, the Massachusetts plan does have an individual mandate, requires everyone living in the state to get insurance. And as they have figured out what the minimum coverage, they have a minimum coverage requirement for the state, they've said they recognize that their initial plan to have everyone have insurance by this July 1st is going to be phased in. So they're going to have a requirement that everyone have health insurance by July 1st, but they're not going to require everyone meet what they're calling minimum creditable coverage until January of 2009. And part of that is that many people do get their insurance from their employers, and not every employer-based insurance matches the minimum coverage. And recognizing that to make that happen is going to involve the employers making changes to their plans. So in order to roll that in, they are saying January of 2009 for your insurance has to meet their minimum standards. Vermont has not established an individual mandate, nor has Maine, but California's does have that as an element. The idea of a purchasing pool has gained some foothold, and Massachusetts has been utilizing the connector. It's an item that's been interesting to California as well. I think particularly in a state that's so big like California, there's been interest in pooling that large number of uninsured. And as mentioned previously, there is a much higher uninsurance rate in California. The one state that that has not had an individual mandate, I wanted to mention in Maine, they had an estimate. It's a smaller state, and they had an estimate that they were going to enroll about 30,000 people. With no individual mandate, they have enrolled about 11,000, which is significantly less than their initial estimates. They do have subsidies like everyone else for people. Massachusetts, Vermont, and Maine all go up to 300, and California is proposing 250. All the programs do have a public expansion. One notable element is in California, there's for children, they're not having a residency requirement, so that children can come into the state and not have a citizenship requirement. Thank you. What they're doing with folks who are not documented in California is that they're not going to enroll in the Medicaid program, but they're going to give them access to a range of clinic settings and basically sort of similar to the uncompensated care that's going on now. One side note is that there's a sort of competing proposal from a number of legislators in California who have suggested that California bill the federal government for the states paying for health care for undocumented immigrants. So it's something that particularly in California is a big issue, and even sort of enough to say, okay, we're going to hand the bill to someone else. Three of the four states in this group have a participation requirement for employers, and as you'll note, it's a not a terribly high fee. It's not meant in any of these states, particularly the Massachusetts discussion, not meant to substitute for paying for health insurance. It's more meant to provide the idea of everyone participating, kind of establishing the concept of participation. And in Maine, There is no requirement. Their main requirement is if you, the main requirement in Maine, I guess, is that if you that if an employer does participate, they have to pay at least 60% of the costs for their employees. But there's no requirement that they do so. The financing piece, which is I know has been a big topic of discussion here, is notable in Massachusetts in that Massachusetts started on a reform plan in part because they were set to lose a significant amount of federal money for the uninsured, and you were able to use this pool of money for the uninsured and turn it into insurance premium funds. And obviously that isn't something that exists in Oregon, but was a big motivator for the work that was done in Massachusetts. In addition, that sort of allows them to have a financing pool that a number of other states don't have. California obviously doesn't have that, and so they have established a payroll tax. Other states have chosen to rely on general fund, on Medicaid match, and in Maine they have an assessment on the health insurers. They try to figure out how much they've been spending on compensated care, and they in doing coverage for people say, well, okay, we're going to get some money back from you now that you're getting compensated for that previously uncompensated care. The other piece that is notable is cost containment. There's been some discussion of Massachusetts that they haven't had a big focus on cost containment. And it's their goal is to recapture some savings for the insured by reducing the number of uninsured, and therefore the portion of what all insured people pay. In Oregon, it's estimated it's about 10% of family premiums is the cost shift for paying for the uninsured. So they're saying that when everyone's insured, that there will be savings there, but they don't have a lot of other delivery system changes. California is working on a number of delivery system related changes for benefits. They have proposed some programs that will give people incentives to have healthy behaviors, particularly for things like diabetes, obesity, smoking, and this is actually something that is also happening in Florida, where Medicaid enrollees are given basically credits for engaging in healthy behaviors, going to primary care visits, engaging in smoking cessation, et cetera, and then they can use that money to pay for their portion of pharmaceuticals, et cetera. I feel like I don't want to just read the, since you all, you know, have what I'm reading from in front of you, I don't want to just read that, but you may tell me what I'm missing.
I guess I would just add the other points to note is some of the issues that were raised by your previous speaker is that all of you should have received, the office puts out a report every 2 years called the Trends in Healthcare, and there are chapters in there on who are the uninsured in terms of both age and income level. There's some data in here about who's taking up insurance, who's not. There's information about the Oregon Health Plan current status that's been run through DMAP. But it's a nice resource. We've also in the back laid out some of these proposals as well. So there's a great deal of information available to you. It's also available on the web as well. But if we can answer any questions specifically, we will.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Pipes, will you join us? We have about 20 minutes that we can deal with discussion. Representative Cannon, I think
Thank you.
You had first dibs?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for Ms. Pipes. Thank you for your testimony. Would you agree that a system where citizens are prohibited from purchasing health care privately is a single-payer system?
Yes, such as in Canada, individual health insurance is illegal under the Canada Health Act.
In your reading of the Oregon proposals, did you find any restriction or prohibition on the ability of citizens to purchase their own health care?
I have to say I am not a total expert on the Oregon system because I focus all of my work on California and Massachusetts. So, but in reviewing the summaries of your documents, I see, well, you can still purchase individual insurance. All of these boards that you're setting up will be determining what goes into insurance plans and pricing and price controls. So I see this is going to be much more expensive than you, you know, if it passes, than you plan. And therefore, the answer to this will be we need to move down the road to a single-payer system.
Just a quick follow-up to that. I appreciate that this was just one. I'm picking out a couple of words of your testimony, which was single payer, and you brought up a lot of issues in it. But those are words that, in a lot, I think can incite anxiety and worry, and we should be very careful about how we use them.
Absolutely.
And there is nothing in, I think, you wouldn't find anything in these Oregon proposals that would eliminate or restrict the ability of Oregonians to purchase private health insurance as they saw fit, or private health care as they see fit. And so I would just caution all of us to be careful about using those words, single payer. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to comment on that? Is there anything in the Oregon, any of the proposals that talk about fixing prices on health insurance and things like that?
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, no, there's no, we don't talk about. Well, my greatest knowledge is from the Oregon Health Policy Commission standpoint, but also from the proposals for large-scale reform. There's not a talk about fixing prices or even requiring that everyone have the sort of go through one mold. For in particular, the Oregon Health Policy Commission recommendations, and this is echoed in House Bill 3368, that the exchange is set up as a way for people to access insurance options, but doesn't mandate that they use the exchange or that they use products that go through the exchange. Also, insurance companies can have the same product available through the exchange and also through without the exchange. Also wanted to note that in the Health Policy Commission's recommendations, we suggest that the exchange function as a voluntary entity for business and for any individual who's buying health insurance on their own. The only people for whom there would be some restrictions in terms of what packages they could purchase would be those who are using state subsidies to purchase insurance. And the goal of that is to make sure that those are packages that include primary care and prevention and are not stripped down benefits that were kind of emergency services only types of programs. And that's the main restriction from the Health Policy Commission.
And I would just add, from looking at all the bills comparatively for Senator Bates and Westland's committee, that there was all the bills have some about buying supplemental coverage on top in the private market, such as 27, where it's more of a basic benefit that all get, but then they can buy on top or buy up for services.
You're welcome to join in anytime, Ms. Bates.
Well, just to say that, you know, when the Massachusetts plan passed in April a year ago, you know, and the estimates of costs and what the connector would do, when it actually came into pass, as you rightly mentioned, there's a delay on, you know, implementing a lot of this, and it's also partly because insurers were not able to offer plans at the prices that the voters were told they could. So we have to be wary of that. And you also, once the connector board got operational, they started determining, you know, what is a plan and what has to be in a plan. So you have to be careful when you set up a connector or an exchange that, you know, you don't put too many controls on, which make it impossible for insurers to offer these plans at the price. And in fact, in Maine, there's only one insurer, which is Anthem, because nobody else has entered the market under the Durago plan.
Thank you. We have Those are Kotek, Maurer, and Richardson.
I'll pass.
You start with Kotek.
I'm passing.
Oh, okay. Is there a mouse?
Mr. Chair, thank you. This could be a lot of fun. I have
several. Representative Richardson proposed it because he's just a fun guy.
I've heard that.
Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of time here. And I have to apologize, Ms. Pipes, but I'm a freshman in the minority, so they give me all sorts of obstacles here. I'm just kidding.
I'll change things for you. Time's up.
I will have to take exception on page 6 of your testimony. You say that the reimbursement is a respective 92-cent, 95-cent for each dollar of care provided. Unfortunately, in the state of Oregon, it's substantially worse than that because we're an underfunded Medicare state, and unfortunately, the state doesn't have enough money to provide cost dollars in most cases. And that's not really a question, unless you want to address it.
Right. No, I know. sorry, I can't see.
That's all right.
Different states have different rates, but it is true that a lot of docs, particularly in California and in other states, are declining to take Medicare and Medicaid patients because the reimbursement rates are too low. And, in fact, in Arnold Schwarzenegger's plan, he has a $5.5 billion transfer from Medicaid into California to cover higher reimbursement rates to doctors to try and attempt to stop doctors not taking Medi-Cal patients. But of course, who's going to pay for that $5.5 billion if the U.S. government gave a waiver? It would be all people in other states, which would be detrimonious to people here in Oregon. So I think that's a very interesting point. And also, what wasn't mentioned was that Arnold wants everybody to share in the cost of health care. So he has a 2% tax on gross revenue of doctors. So if, in fact, doctors get higher Medi-Cal reimbursement rates, they're going to be paying a 2% tax on a higher gross income. So this is an important fact. And the 4% payroll tax on employers of 10 or more employees in California is double the rate that it is in Massachusetts. So just to finish your point, I'd like to say healthcare is like unraveling an onion. There are many tearful moments, and it's very difficult to unravel.
Yeah, but it tastes great when you finish.
Yeah.
I have a couple more. We did have.
Oh, you get twice as many questions.
A Minute Clinic organization. It wasn't Minute Clinic, but you know those in right. An organization in Portland that practiced here. I believe was. I don't even want to say the name. Was here for several months. Left the market because the market did not sustain it. Went back to Kansas or where Missouri or wherever they were from. And then my other point here is we talk about rationing because the system is really not, the current system is not a free market system. We have so many, the consumer so protected from the free market side, and so you know, one of the talks has been about certificates of need. And you address that. What other things can we do in this system that we have today? And I know we want to change that, but what are things that we can do today that can increase the consumer connection between the actual cost of providing services and their selection when they do have a choice? Because there are obviously many times when the consumer doesn't have a choice, which emergency room they end up in after a crash. So.
Right. I don't know the answer to the specific reason why the Ready Clinic, Minute Clinic left here, but they certainly are on the increase all across America, and it's cheaper to go there than to an emergency room. What else can be done? Well, as I mentioned, if with health savings accounts and with catastrophic high deductible insurance, I mean, if companies can offer a high deductible insurance plan with, you know, fewer mandates, insurance should be there for catastrophes. Just like, you know, you don't buy your house insurance to replace your roof, you don't buy your car insurance to replace your tires. We have in this country a system of first dollar coverage, so people think insurance is very cheap because they pay no copay, $10, $20, or $30. So we need to put
we need to, people to become more responsible about how they spend their healthcare dollars. And I think once there is more competition with more insurers entering the market, you're going to see more price transparency and more competition in what prices for things cost. I also support John Shattuck's bill, which he introduced last year in the House, so that people could buy insurance across state lines. So if you live in Oregon and you have 32 mandates, you live in California, you have 46, you know, you could go to Idaho, which is a much lower mandated state, and get your insurance there. So people should have flexibility, and we should allow the market to work. One thing I didn't mention is one of the governor's good plans, i.e. in reducing the ratio between doctors and nurse practitioners in certificates of need, changing the tax treatment of HSAs. I also support the idea of setting up a subsidy for the working poor who cannot afford insurance so that they can get insurance through the state-subsidized managed pool in California. And I think other states can do that. When these people, you know, move up the income ladder, then they can move off to having their own insurance, either through an employer or through setting up their own HSA. And governors, former Governor Jeb Bush of Florida, Governor Sanford of South Carolina, and the governor of Georgia have introduced health opportunity accounts for the Medicaid population that I think is a very good way to put patients and doctors back in charge. It's not for every patient on Medicaid, but for a lot, it's working very well, and you're going to see reduced costs.
Thank you. Incidentally, I do, in a residence I have out of state, I do buy insurance for maintenance, which is a thriving market in some places. And every time the toilet goes bad, I call somebody, pay my $35, and they fix it.
Right.
Representative Richardson?
Thank you. I've been kind of intrigued from the comment that and the question that Representative Cannon asked. Is that my basic understanding, and clarify this if it's wrong, is that if the government says we're going to utilize private insurance companies to give us an open market approach, but there's going to be 31 mandates, and the basic policy that's going to be, we'll have to have these benefits, this chronic care treatment plan, this kind of preventive plan, to me that is no longer a private enterprise approach. It's more of a contract enterprise approach where the insurance companies become surrogates for the government. But I mean, is that an incorrect view, or any of you have a comment on whether or not that it is really a free market approach when you have the government directing, whether it's a board or whatever?
Right. Well, I would say it's when you have mandates and regulations that are set by government for insurance companies, it's not a free market approach. And that's why I think that, you know, if you want to buy an insurance plan that has in vitro fertilization and alcohol rehabilitation.
I was thinking.
Exactly, yes. Then you should be able to. Yeah, right, exactly. So
I think he's figured out how it's done.
Right.
It took me 5 before I figured it out. And by then I was addicted, and it didn't matter.
So, and then if I want a plan just to cover catastrophic, and I want to pay things out of pocket myself or out of my HSA, I mean, that's bringing free market provisions into the health insurance market. But, you know, even in California, under Schwarzenegger's plan, he has a wellness feature, too, in addition to community rating and guaranteed issue. So a prevention wellness mandate is going to add further to the costs of health insurance in California, so it's making it more difficult for providers to provide a reasonable package. So mandates to me are, you know, one of the things. I mean, if you want all those mandates, you should be able to buy a plan with that. But if you don't, you should be able to get a plan that suits your need. But if the government says you can't offer a plan without those mandates, that destroys a free market in healthcare. And oh, I meant
if
to mention,
quick,
we're out of time. No, 45% of the healthcare business in this country is in the hands of government. Politicians now want the other 65%.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The million-dollar question for me, the billion-dollar question for me, Spipes, is we talked about the things that are the problems that we're having in the various states. You're very familiar with the states and the countries and various plans available. We're looking for a good way to not only have a free market approach, but we want to provide access of care. We want to control cost containment. We want to have, you know, transparency and have it be affordable and sustainable. Can you point us to the best model that you're aware of where these things are actually happening
in the United States?
Let me answer that question as well, because it was very much where I was going. Where this is happening, but also I'll ask both of you. As you look around the whole world, you quote in your book Solzhenitsyn's ideal medical care system and something that happened in Russia before 1918, but or I guess that was Dr. Friedman that did.
Right.
But what would you say, looking around the whole world, where would we go to look at the ideal healthcare system in your mind? And I'll ask you guys to answer that question as well.
Well, I would say the best healthcare system in the world is here in the United States. Why is it that Silvio Berlusconi, the former Prime Minister of Italy, came to the Cleveland Clinic to have his pacemaker put in rather than going to London or to Switzerland or to even having it done in Italy? Why is it so many Canadians who are on a wait list come to America to get their healthcare and pay out of pocket? Because we do. Why did Jordan's King Hussein come to Hopkins to have his cancer treatment and not go to Europe? We do have some problems, which I have outlined. We do have solutions for Med-Mal reform, getting rid of mandates and regulations. Switzerland, I think, of all the countries, probably has the best system. I mean, I think it's odd in this country when we turn age 65 that we have to enter a government health care program. I mean, now with health savings accounts, I think the legislation should be changed so that when people reach 65, if they don't need to go on Medicare, if they have enough money in their HSA and they can still have their catastrophic insurance, it would take a lot of pressure off the government Medicare system to allow people to have decisions. In Switzerland, people, when you graduate from college or you start to work, you get your own insurance, and it goes with you through life, because when you're young, you have very few, for the most part, medical bills. As you get older, you need to use health care out of the pool. In Great Britain, the British Labour Party has always said the worst mistake they ever made in setting up National Health Service was to allow the private health market to exist side by side, because people could compare, you know, a waiting list on NHS versus using private BUPA insurance. And so Canada didn't
have taken that. Is that right?
Canada didn't take the mistake.
We need to keep moving a little bit here. But just as a follow-up, we have the best healthcare system in the country, and it's 45% in the hands of government. Do we improve it by making it more in the hands of government?
No, we make it better by reducing that 45%.
But it's better because, I mean, in a sense, we have a system that's 45%. How do you know it goes that way?
Well, because I come from a country where government ran 100% of the healthcare system, and I know what it means to have long lines for care, ration care, and a lack of equipment that allows people to, you know, get an MRI or a CT scan.
And 100% coverage, and 90% of the population that says they wouldn't give it up if they had a chance.
People in Canada that are basically healthy like the healthcare system. There's no question about that. But people that need to have surgeries and go on waiting lists, they don't like it. A woman stood up in Ottawa in Parliament and with her health care card and said, what good is this card to me if I cannot get health care and I can't get a doctor? 3.2 million Canadians out of 32 are waiting to get a primary care doctor. You know, if you have to wait 17.7 weeks.
That's much less than here.
No, I don't think so.
Many here do not have a primary health care doctor, certainly.
Well, I don't believe that, because through the various programs that are there, it's just, I don't know the exact number, I have to say, but I don't think that is true. But Canadians come to the U.S. for care because if they can afford it, they pay out of pocket. And a lot of private clinics are being set up illegally in Canada because there is such a wait for people that the government is afraid to shut down these private clinics. And in Quebec, a year ago June, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled that because of Canadians are entitled under the Charter to life, liberty, and the security of the individual, because of these long waiting lists, Canadians in Quebec were not secure, and therefore they allowed Quebec to open up to private health care clinics so that there can be increased supply of health care.
We'll have one more question, then we have to end this. President Gelder?
I was just going to add that there are 17% uninsured in the state of Oregon who do not have access to a primary care doctor except through able to get into a community care clinic when they can. I would also add that the health outcomes of the United States are far below those of other countries. Mexico has in their constitution the HOPE initiative, that it's a constitutional right to health care, although they have certain problems in terms of how that care is delivered. And I would say that there's probably some good features in a lot of different systems. Australia and New Zealand have wonderful quality and practice standards and clinical guidelines. There's the sickness funds in Germany that are very interesting to look at. So I'm not sure anyone has the best outcomes, but if you look, I mean, the best solution, but if you look at healthcare outcomes, we are very much lower down the list. And a lot of Americans are choosing to go get their healthcare in India and get their bypass surgery there because it's more affordable when they have no insurance. So there is there's a sort of a two-way street in some of these debates.
There we go. Last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And short answers, please.
Great. You all spoke word for word the thoughts that were informing my question as they rattled through my head. But what I'm wondering, I'm wanting to ask this question just a little bit differently. If we take away who runs the system and we look instead at health outcomes, what are infant mortality rates? What are the mortality and morbidity rates? And the issue of access. Does everyone have access, whether you're young or you're old, whether you have a disability, you're regularly healthy, or you need an emergent surgery? Who has the best combination of those systems, regardless of who pays, whether it's single payer, multi-payer, who has the best combination of access and health outcomes together?
I think one thing we need to look at is, in this country, just because you don't have health insurance doesn't mean you don't get health care. So I personally think that, you know, we need to improve access by the various things that I've talked about. But I do think we have the very best, and some change is needed. It was something that you said I was going to comment on, and I can't now remember.
Can I follow up with a clarification?
Sorry, could you just repeat your question?
Sure, and I think I didn't ask it very well. So if you take away the part, I think that you identified it very clearly. I'm not talking about health insurance, who has the best health insurance system. I care less about that than I do about people being healthy and people having access to health and health outcomes. So maybe they private pay, they don't have insurance, maybe they're part of a universal health, single-payer health coverage plan. But in your research, what country, what state has the best combination of actual health outcomes and access to care, regardless of whether that's insurance or private pay?
Right, and let me just say that the research that has come out recently, I mean, if you look at, people always say to me, well, Canadians live on average longer than Americans, therefore the single-payer system must work well. But you have to compare apples to apples. Canada has a very different demographic makeup than America. We don't have a large proportion, a large population of people that are minority. As I mentioned, 14 million people are eligible for Medicaid and SCHIP and haven't signed up. We need to get a program so that these people can learn about this and sign up for the coverage that's accessible to and available to them. So we have that, but in Canada doesn't have a large military. We don't, you know, we don't have a lot of deaths from military. But if you compare, say, me to you, if I come down with breast cancer, diagnosed with breast cancer in Canada versus in the U.S., and you in the U.S., the outcomes now show that Americans are living longer with a similar type of breast cancer. The same is true for prostate cancer in men, and the stats show between Britain, Germany, Canada, and the U.S., the outcomes comparing similar demographics, similar age groups, the outcomes in America are the best in the world. And we have access to the very best new drugs that you know, my uncle couldn't get Rituxan for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in Canada. The Cancer Control Agency told him to go to Seattle to get it. So, you know, a lot of these wonderful new drugs are used to combat early diagnosed breast cancer, you know, drugs like Herceptin and things that just aren't available in Canada.
We have to end this discussion. Thank you very much for coming. Thanks for being
part
of this.
Thank you
guys for joining us. I really appreciate it. This has been very interesting. We need another 4 hours for this,
right.
I think.
Yes, it's the onion. Just never unraveled
right.
enough.
Thank you. I'll close the informational meeting on healthcare reform. I'd like to get the work sessions out of the way first. I'd like to do this in reverse order at the moment. So let me open a work session first on HB 2867. Sandy, would you comment on that bill? And
sure, Mr. Chair.
And I guess I'm the carrier from the subcommittee on both these bills. And can we have the ODA representative and the hygienist representative join us for a moment at the podium?
And Mr. Brock is here as well if you want to ask him a question. I don't know if you need him. The board is here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 2867, you'll recall, is modifying the definition of dental hygiene to include the assessment for and to apply dental sealants and fluoride. This came out of the policy subcommittee, had a public hearing on the 15th and a work session yesterday where the subcommittee adopted the Dash 1 amendments that I believe is behind your SMS.
And also we have a hand in roll.
And you... I don't know if I passed that to the full committee, the old version, just the amendment. But we were also, and Mr. Chair, you can interrupt me at any point. You will notice on the Dash 1 amendments down on line 6, it says presents evidence satisfactory to the board of at least 2,000 hours. The folks involved in this bill were instructed yesterday in the subcommittee to go off and find a compromise, and we were put on notice to be prepared to make some sort of conceptual amendment to this. I alerted LC to that effect, not knowing what the ultimate decision would be until this committee today. And so, Mr. Chair, I believe that...
The bill, as accepted with the Dash 1 amendments, was a unified bill, except for the number. There was agreement on all parties as we got the Dash 1s. And we have a magic number.
We do. Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, I'm Kathleen Cosgrove. I'm here today representing the Oregon Dental Hygiene Association, and pleased that we do, in fact, have a magic number, which is 2,500 hours, and look forward to working closely with the Oregon Dental Association to pass this bill in both chambers. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to say how much I appreciate, Chair Green, like your leadership on helping us come to an agreement on this bill.
For the record, please.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Margie Hoffman. I represent the Oregon Dental Association and other members of the committee. I really appreciate your time in working with both the Hygienist Association and the Dental Association on this bill.
So what we have the bill amended with the Dash 1 amendments. We need a conceptual amendment motion to amend the bill as amended. Where are we? On what it would it's what is on line 6 of the Dash 1 amendments, from 2,000 hours to 2,500 hours. We've been told by the chief clerk that we can do that. And
Mr. Chair, I would move that we amend the Dash 1 amendments. Page 1, line 6, to read 2,500 hours instead of 2,000 hours.
Is there any objection to that? Any discussion? So done. Now, a motion on the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2867 as amended with the Dash 1 amendments. And with the conceptual change for 2,500 hours. To the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Maher?
Thank you. We have many bills that talk about health care, and this is one of the bills that actually addresses health care reform in making, and I will say dental care, I'll bring that under the umbrella of medical care, that this is about opening up access to health care, dental care, and so this is an excellent bill.
Thank you. Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you, the dental hygienist and the dental association for working on this. I agree with Representative Maher.
And the board.
And the board of dentistry, yes. Thank you very much. This is about creating additional routes for access with trained professionals, so thank you.
Any other discussion? Do we have a motion? We do have a motion on the floor. The assistant, please call the roll.
Aye.
Excuse. We'll stand at ease for a moment. We
George, which bill?
We're in the dental hygienist bill with total agreement on both sides, and a so far unanimous vote.
I just needed a bill number. Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. The motion passes. Do we have a volunteer to carry it?
I will. No, he jumped in first.
Yes, Representative Maurer.
No, okay.
Thank you very much. Representative Maurer will carry it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you guys very much, and the board as well.
Mr. Chair, you can close out. I'm sorry.
Close the session?
Yes.
I mean the work session?
Work session.
Close the work session on HB 2867.
Just for the record, I should ask this before. I look at the price of these documents, and there's $14.95, and I'm wondering if this has already been addressed.
But it turns out books are exempted. Books and printed material are exempted from the gift.
So I don't have to give this to a nonprofit?
No, it's a free speech issue, apparently. It's the same issue that Jim Gardner was raising with us on the dental.
Okay.
Gelson.
I feel much better now. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I've had the unique opportunity of chairing the House Guidelines Committee.
Here we have an expert.
And Representative Richardson makes, together, we make up 2/3 of the House Guidelines Committee.
So no business here.
And
quorum. Yeah, you have to be careful. You have a quorum.
Oh, we do. So
you
we're not really.
To not talk to each
okay,
other.
Okay, we don't talk. But it's not all books and printed materials. Books and printed materials related to our work.
Related to the work.
Here.
Well, just to add to it, the rule of thumb is if you could buy it with your service and supplies account, then it's okay. And this is the kind of book that you could buy to help be a more effective legislator.
However, if it came with a hot dog, we would have to have further conversation.
or under $9.99.
For a smoothie parfait.
Okay. Let me open a work session on HB 2524. Did I see Bruce Bishop lurking back there?
Yes.
There he is. Will you join us to help explain what we have? This is a...
I just wanted to alert from yesterday's conversation, we had a fair amount of discussion on the Dash 5s having inclusive language that would exclude the Healthcare Association. And we did meet in council this morning, and that they, I believe it is my understanding, and I think folks in the room...
Lauren is here,
as is Tina.
Come on, Lauren, join us.
There is agreement, and the new language is, as you referenced yesterday in the Dash 5, and this is on the Dash 6 amendments, page 2, line 15.
Do we have Dash 6?
You should have it in your packet, Mr. Chair. I have one for you, if you do.
I'm sure.
That tightens up to the satisfaction of all parties and has created a comfort zone that everybody's okay about the duplicity of reporting and nobody being...
No, I'm not sure that's the
right word. That's not the right word?
Not duplicity.
Duplicity. English wasn't my major.
Duplicity sounds like it's something bad.
Oh. Well, I will defer to the folks at the table.
We have an agreement. Is that...
It's right? My understanding.
We have words in the
here.
Dash 6. Is that right? Thank you. Okay, this is a fairly complicated bill. The folks that heard it in the subcommittee, I think, may have a fighting chance at understanding where we are. This also comes as a consensus bill. It was designed by folks working together, the Hospital Association and others working on it. We had one issue left over yesterday. And if they're covered in the Dash 6s, that would be good. But, Bruce, if you would just give us an overview on where we got, at least through the Dash 5s.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. What the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2524 do is to develop a healthcare facility infections reporting system for the state to make that information available publicly. That was the purpose of the original bill. We are using a process that was developed through the Oregon Patient Safety Commission and a work group that it convened on addressing infections reporting, using that model as the blueprint for the amendments to House Bill 2524, basically taking that model and extending it to make available information about healthcare facility acquired infections. So it is a flexible program in state statute in that it's not as prescriptive as the original bill was in terms of putting into statute what would be reported, but it accomplishes the same purpose with a process that that is already underway. That's sort of the high-level review of the bill, and if you have specific questions about it, I could go through it.
And it has the hospitals and other health facilities reporting information to the state, which will eventually get to your shop. Is that right, Tina? Would you introduce yourself?
For the record, I'm Tina Edlund. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the Office of Health Policy and Research.
And this will come through eventually.
Right, the hospital.
DHS to you.
Well, not through DHS to us, directly to us, to our office. Yes.
Lauren, will you introduce yourself?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lauren Rhodes, representing the Oregon Healthcare Association, and we have been actively involved in the development of this legislation, and I think the Dash 6 amendments meet our needs in terms of avoiding, wherever possible, duplication, not duplicity of reporting.
Yeah, we're talking about duplicity, too, I think. The Healthcare Association would have preferred long-term care institutions to be left out, primarily because they have a completely separate reporting system on infections that goes through the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And what we had reached a compromise is that we would find a way to get language that allowed the reports they were making to be the reports that fed into this system in terms of the state report. Can you folks tell me where, and oh, incidentally, is Dash 6 a complete substitute for Dash 5?
Correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the specific line that we're talking about is on page 2 of the bill, and it's line 15, subsection 3, I'm sorry, line 17, I guess, is the specific language where it says, to the extent practicable and appropriate to avoid unnecessary duplication of reporting by facilities. And it, by using the word facilities, it expands the group to other facilities that may come under similar requirements from CMS in the future or maybe under existing requirements that I'm not aware of at this point.
Great. Representative Maurer, did you have?
Yes. Mr. Bishop, the question has to do with the Joint Commission standards and how this ties into a hospital's desire to comply with both state requirements and JCO requirements. Is this consistent?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I think it is not inconsistent. It may be not altogether aligned with some of those other requirements, but this language would give us the flexibility, if there are new federal requirements, at least to be consistent with those. I'm not sure that it encompasses JCO reporting requirements expressly, but I would hope and expect that the Office of Health Policy and Research in putting it together would be cognizant of those reporting requirements as well and take those into account as they develop this Oregon-specific program.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank the Office of Health Policy and Research for being willing to take this on. Your thoughts on a fiscal for this, and this is additional work for you.
Yes, there will be a fiscal on this. What the number?
No.
What about the magnitude, though? Is it going to be a large fiscal?
I think that it will be around $300,000.
Sandy, when? How does it work on getting a fiscal from this? We pass it and then it gets a fiscal?
Correct.
Or?
since we got the amendment today, sir, I was not able to ship it to fiscal quick enough to get them to turn it around to us for the hearing. So they will get this amendment and then issue a fiscal statement on it, and then there'll be additional discussion on whether it needs to come back to the committee.
Or to Ways and Means.
Or to Ways and Means. You know, there's some other logistics that can happen at that juncture.
Thank you, Sandy. Mr. Chair, that was going to be my question. $300,000 is a significant fiscal, and I'm a little concerned about just letting it slough along the process, and then all of a sudden, oops, we have something that should have been referred to Ways and Means.
Well, with that fiscal, it will automatically, before it goes to the floor, either come back here or go to Ways and Means. It'll be handled by the Speaker's Office, is that right, Sandy?
Correct.
I mean, it's automatic. We won't be sending it to the floor with a $300,000 fiscal on it without having it first going through Ways and Means. This is the first time I've heard the number on the fiscal.
Yeah, and I think all of our eyes went a little wide on that. But just I would just like to have that assurance because I've seen some bills on the floor that did have fiscals that didn't get referred to Ways and Means, and it seems to be a sliding scale and nothing that's kind of says this is the benchmark.
Well, 50,000 is usually the benchmark.
That has been historically true. But we have overlooked that particular benchmark.
This will have a fiscal statement before it goes somewhere. And if the fiscal statement is $300,000 or in that area, it will definitely either come back here or go to Ways and Means.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may help clarify, sometimes, and you folks might have noticed, on the floor, the carrier will stand up and say, da-da-da-da-da, this needs to go to Ways and Means. And so from the floor, then that referral can be added onto this bill, or it can then, the carrier will ask to have it re-referred back to committee, which then will reconsider it and move it to Ways and Means.
You're right.
So well, that can be done. That's not...
I have to wait. Process.
No, it should go to Ways. If it's going to have that kind of a fiscal, it should go to Ways and Means.
So are you planning on working this?
Well, I was planning on working it today until 5 minutes ago. Can we get a fiscal?
As soon as they get the information.
Have they been working with you on this?
No, we've just been working internally.
Okay, let's adopt the dash sixes today then, and let's hold it and ask for a fiscal as soon as possible. And then if it is in the neighborhood of $300,000, we'll move it to Ways and Means. Okay? I don't have a motion on the table. I need a motion to adopt the dash sixes.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we adopt the dash six amendments to House Bill 2524.
Is there any discussion on that? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As the person who was acting as vice chair yesterday when we moved this over to the full committee with a very lengthy discussion about making sure that the Oregon Health Care Association needs were met, I know we had Ms. Rhodes testify about that, but I'm looking at this and I'm trying to figure out if that additional language about avoiding unnecessary duplication actually takes place in the rulemaking process. I think it does, but I'm not sure, and I just wanted to make clear on the record that we intended for their needs to be addressed, and I believe it's in the rulemaking process, and hopefully that'll get clarified.
Right. The rulemaking process will describe specifically how each of the institutions need to report. And we're guiding them with this, that they need to work things out so as to not create...
I'm further clarifying that, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yes, that's how I would read that, because Section 3 there is really talking about C above, where it says prescribing the form, which is the responsibility of the program. So I think you're right. This is all that would be addressed in rulemaking.
They feel comfortable with that. All right. Are there any objections to the dash 6 amendment? We'll accept the dash 6 amendments. We'll close the work session of HB 2524 as amended with the dash 6 amendments. I'll extend our thanks to both Bruce and to all the team that worked on it, especially to Tom Powers from my staff who worked very hard helping this happen. We'll try and get a fiscal as fast as we can and decide what we need to do with it at that point. And, well, not to decide. If the fiscal is in that nature,
just determines
our action will be to move to Ways and Means.
Yeah.
Right.
May I make a suggestion?
Yes, please.
On this, when we look at the fiscal, is there a way for the office to consider ways to reduce the fiscal? For example, you know, I don't see in here, usually sometimes we talk about not compensating people on the advisory committee and some other things. I don't know if the $300,000 is just all staffing or there are other things. So if there are suggestions from the office for how we might reduce the fiscal, that would be helpful as well when we're talking about
that. While you're doing that, I mean, if there are ways to get it, I mean, the answer is we'd have to get it something like under $50,000. If there's a way to do that by amending it, let's have that conversation. That's a great idea, Representative Cote. And if not, then we'll go with it. Excuse me?
No, I
understand, and you need to make sure you have the resources you need to do the job that we're talking about.
Well, it just saves Ways and Means Committee people time to then tinker with it. You know, give us your best estimate, tightest you can before it goes to the South.
Okay.
Thank
I did
you.
Close the session, right?
Yes. I think so.
You can close the work session.
I think I closed the work session on 2-5 on 2-8-6. No, 2-5-2-4. And I'll open a public hearing on 3-2-9-0. And Kevin Earls, will you come up and tell us what you're proposing here? Well, I was hoping Mr. Earls would do that, but let's ask Sandy. I have that bad habit of not
that's
doing
fine.
That.
That's fine.
You should kick me when I
don't.
It's like Harriet does all the time.
Plus we're working by Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, House Bill 3290 comes before you as Representative Greenlick as the chief sponsor, Senator Ronna Sanderson, at the request of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. It's requiring that the administrator of the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research to establish a community benefit reporting system for hospitals that are operating in Oregon to produce the report of the data received and provide a report to the governor and the Legislative Assembly and to the public. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
They presupposed what they're going to do.
I think they did.
In Oprah. Okay. Mr. Earls, please, if you would introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kevin Earls, Vice President of Finance and Health Policy for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. And on behalf of Oregon's 57 acute care hospitals and the patients that we serve, thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I am very pleased to be with you to provide some background on House Bill 3290. It is a proposal that originated with our association at the specific request of our board and is part of our association's continuing effort to provide additional information, resources, and public information available to policymakers and the people of Oregon. I would also like to mention that we are pleased to have recently been able to present this bill for consideration by the Oregon Health Policy Commission, of which Chair Greenlick is a member, a advisory commission made up of labor, consumer, and policy professionals, and that bill was considered and adopted with unanimous support from the commission a week ago. Let me begin by walking through what the bill does. Sandy, I think, hit the high notes, but it establishes a new mandatory hospital reporting system for annual reporting of hospital community benefit expenditures. And the reporting system and the expenditures that are reported on the basis of cost. And I should mention that we've also brought -2 amendments as part of your consideration today. There are three specific objectives in that amendment, and I'll address those at the conclusion of my testimony. The reporting system that we envision in this bill will be based upon actual cost. It utilizes standard categories and definitions used in the reporting of community benefit expenditures by hospitals across the United States. It is the origins of community benefit reporting really began with the Catholic Hospital Association and later the VHA, another broad hospital trade association, national trade association. CHA and VHA combined efforts a few years ago to create a national standard that created consistent accounting terms and definitions for community benefit reporting so that there is a true apples and apples kind of data flow that comes out of community benefit reporting. So what's included in community benefit? This is a term which is common in our industry, particularly for our hospital members that are not-for-profit. And to give you some perspective, out of 57 hospitals in Oregon, 55 of them are not-for-profit or tax-exempt. Community benefit really means capturing the costs associated with those activities that a hospital provides in the course of its operation that are designed to meet identified community health needs. And there are specific examples outlined, I think starting on line 17 of the bill. So they include charity care as well as losses related to government-sponsored programs like Medicaid, CHIP, Medicare, CALM, and other federally mandated programs. They also include things like community health improvement activities, research, financial and in-kind contributions to the community, as well as community building activities that affect health in the local community where the hospital exists. What is not included in community benefit reporting are the items of bad debt, contractual write-offs or allowances, and hospital expenditures that are made on behalf of hospital marketing activities. So who will receive and evaluate the data that's being collected under this program? It would be in Section 3, it identifies the Office of Health Policy and Research as being charged with the development of the data collection program, and it gives them rulemaking authority to carry out its charge. OHPR is directed to produce an annual report for the governor and the legislature and the public at large, and the data that's collected under this reporting system is in fact public once it's provided to OHPR. Well, why is community benefit reporting important? And I think this is, you know, obviously the heart of the matter and the area where you may have the most interest. And I guess I would start by saying that as long as healthcare funding is inadequate, there is going to need to be dialogue around whether the parties that are involved in providing healthcare are doing their fair share of helping meet public needs. And in order for that dialogue to be productive, you have to have a common data set, a fact-based data set that collects financial data on an apples and apples basis that allows comparison across communities, between hospitals, and between other actors, if you will, in the healthcare equation. And we think that this is a way, in putting this bill forward, that we can advance that dialogue. Now, on any given day, there can be discussions in this state about whether or not Hospital A is doing enough versus Hospital B, particularly if A and B happen to be in the same market and are competing. There can be questions about whether a not-for-profit hospital is doing enough relative to a for-profit counterpart that's in the same region. This kind of common data set then begins to create a platform for those kinds of conversations. It's an attempt to try and make hospital data open and transparent and comparable in a way that can help facilitate that dialogue. And I would also tell you that that dialogue is not just about hospitals. Obviously, though hospitals provide hundreds of millions of dollars in this state every year to try and meet unmet community health needs, we can't do it alone. So having this platform of data then can help foster a larger dialogue about the amount that's being spent from state resources and the amount that employers are contributing, a much broader dialogue to help evaluate how we're funding healthcare and how we're spending our money. In addition, as I mentioned, most Oregon hospitals are tax exempt, and we want to be able to respond to public expectations about our mission and the value that we bring to the communities that we serve in exchange for that status. We believe in being accountable to the communities that we serve, and we believe that this bill makes an enormous commitment to that accountability. It's a big step. OAHHS believes that the public reporting required under 3290 will create change and new opportunities for our own members, and I want to spend a couple minutes on that. First, we believe that there'll be a more proactive approach towards community benefit expenditures once a uniform system is in place. I see a process where, and this occurs with some larger systems now, but where community benefit expenditures are more proactively planned and budgeted for, where there is a survey process to evaluate unmet community need for health care services, and where hospitals begin to put together a community benefit expenditure plan within their budgeting process that meets those things that have been identified up front. Very often, hospitals are turned to help sponsor community activities that have a health orientation, but they're kind of pop-up opportunities. They're not necessarily planned in advance. So one element of this, I think, is the opportunity for hospitals to have kind of a more front-end evaluation process for how to spend community benefit dollars. Second, we believe that that there will be a kind of a best practices process that will emerge when hospitals begin to develop and report their community benefit expenditures in a public manner. So they'll be looking at one another and saying, you know, hey, this hospital does this with their community benefit expenditures. That seems to be really effective. We should incorporate that into our next year. So I think in a way you can see that all boats can begin to float with this kind of best practices phenomenon that would emerge from public reporting. And third, I think with the adoption of community benefit reporting, there will begin to be an opportunity for hospitals to find common areas of interest, particularly where those hospitals serve either a common population or operate in a common catchment area, so that hospitals that are often seen as competitors might contribute a portion of their community benefit dollars together to in cooperation meet as a generally recognized community need for the communities that they serve. On a closing note, I would tell you that OAHHS used a pretty open and collaborative process in trying to develop this bill. We began development as a result of a board planning and retreat process that occurred last summer, and in the fall we began by reaching out to Oregon Health Action Campaign and other community leaders for guidance in how to put this bill together. Ultimately, I come before you today on behalf of our organization sponsoring this alone. It represents, well, I've been able to describe it in maybe a few minutes. This bill, if enacted, represents a tremendous body of work for the hospitals that have committed to make it happen. It will be based on established national standards for definitions and categories of community benefit reporting. It's something that we can implement now and begin to see the fruits of in a short period of time. It's not an experiment. It's a known commodity. It's a known process for helping address this approach. We would urge you to favorably consider the bill. I know that you don't have a work session planned, but we're very eager to get the bill moving. I did tell you that I would address the -2 amendments, and I'd like to do that now. There are three issues that are addressed in the -2s. First, a further clarification from the existing bill that the reporting basis is cost. We thought we had made that clear. some that read the bill when it was first published felt like we weren't clear enough. So in the dash two amendments, you'll find on line 28 that we're inserting the words cost-based into that section to make it very clear that we're using cost-based reporting. The second thing is that we wanted to make it perfectly clear that we're trying to follow the CHA-VHA guidelines, which are the accepted national standard. We can't do that directly, so we inserted language that says this reporting is consistent with established national standards for hospital reporting of community benefit. And then finally, as with all good mandates, there needs to be some teeth in it. And so we added a civil penalties clause for any hospital in Oregon that doesn't comply with the new program. I think this is truly a kind of a man-bites-dog story. You have the hospital industry bringing a mandated community benefit reporting bill to you, asking for your help in passing that and putting civil penalties in as well to help enforce it. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, Kevin, I'd like to start with a question. And Representative Bonamici has a question. There, we're going to get a fiscal on this that's going to be some number. Let's say for a moment it's the same number as it was on the last bill. Maybe that, maybe more, but there will be a fiscal. And it would likely sink it. Would there be any interest in creating a fee-based system that had fees coming with these reports that would pay for the...
Mr. Chair, I should have addressed this at the top of my testimony. I meant to and forgot. But I'm not aware, first of all, I don't think there's a fiscal associated with this bill. Virtually all of the costs that have been identified in the bill are picked up by the hospital's obligation to report the data. We've worked very closely with OHPR staff, and perhaps Tina Edlin could join me at the podium and address the fiscal implications.
Well, but this is true of the bill we just had. No, please join us. I would assume that it'll have a fiscal very similar because it's a similar situation.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, I'm Tina Edlin with the Office of Health Policy and Research. The difference between this bill and the previous bill is that this is already part of our statutory requirement that we collect hospital financial data and report out on it. So the only thing that's changed here is there's some additional rulemaking, which is incorporated by our current staff that we have for the hospital financial reporting, and then it's just the same exact collection process.
So we'll end up with a minimum fiscal, is that right?
Right. I'm thinking none. Okay. I mean, we can do it within our current capacity.
Great.
So,
Representative Bonamici?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Earls. I've been trying to read between the lines a little bit on this, and you helped me a bit when you got to the why, and then it helped me a little bit more when we got to the teeth in the amendment. But you're here representing the hospitals, and I kind of wonder, why can't you just disclose this information? I mean, why is it that some hospitals want to and others don't, and you want everybody to? Or it seems like you already have the information. Why can't you just disclose it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, the answer to that, I think, actually is a short history. And I would tell you that 4 years, we do report much, a plethora of data to the Office of Health Policy and Research currently and have for 18 years or more. And we work very collaboratively with that agency on a number of projects. 4 years ago or so, Tina and I were having a conversation in which she said, you know, we get data from you around charity care. It was really around charity care and uncompensated care, charity care and bad debt. And some of it's reported on costs, some of it's reported on charges. The charges stuff varies from hospital to hospital. It's kind of meaningless. We got a fruit salad here. Could we get to a point where we reported on an apples and apples basis? And the bill you have before you today allows us to do that. Now, I'll tell you that this has been a big deal within our association to get our members to support this. And some of them are doing it kicking and screaming. So, yes, I think it is important to have teeth. It is important to have a bill that requires it. Otherwise, you'll get partial compliance, and as with any data set, then it gets kind of shaky if you don't have everybody in the pool.
You look a little perplexed. Okay.
Senator Cote.
Thank you, Chair Greenlech. I have a couple brief questions. Thank you, Mr. Earls. This is very interesting, though, and I know you put a lot of work into it. A couple questions. When you talk about the types, I appreciate the types, the descriptions of community benefit. Would this include breaking out hospitals versus what maybe a hospital foundation would expend? And I'm thinking primarily around the community building activities. Is that actually how things are done, or am I just making that up?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Kotek, it is not intended to capture the activities of a separately organized foundation. So this is really about the patient care activities and the community benefit activities of the hospital per se.
Of the hospital per se.
Yes.
Okay. Follow up? Thank you. So the way it's written, would this encompass all hospitals, nonprofit and for-profit, because of the reference to the Medicare cost report? Because I'm trying to figure out how you get everybody in here.
Again, Vice Chair Kotek, an important question. Again, I should have covered that in my testimony. Most community benefit laws that I'm aware of tend to focus on the tax-exempt nature of not-for-profit hospitals. We specifically engaged our for-profit hospitals in the development of this bill. They'll be covered by the bill as well.
Great. Thanks. Follow up?
Yes.
On the Dash 2 amendments, thank you. On the Dash 2 amendments, I was thinking about the cost base, and I'm thinking if I were a consumer of this information, would the hospitals be okay with what money you do expend as a percentage of revenue? You know, just a blank number of what you're spending, I don't think gives context, because you have really big hospitals who could be expending a lot just by virtue of their bigger hospitals. A percentage of either profit or revenue, would that be something they'd be open to?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Kotek, it is. Let me respond more expansively than rather just to that one example. We've made it clear that while we don't want to engage in the development of our own experimental system in Oregon, that we want to use a national model that has experience, we are committed to providing answers or responding to any questions such as those within the ability of the system, which is quite large. So, for instance, the Office of Health Policy and Research can now tell you what percent of net patient revenue is expended on charity care. What they can't tell you is if it's not cost-based reporting, it doesn't tell you much. I mean, it gives you kind of a percent of a big number, but you can't relate that to the actual cost. And that's where I think the real transparency comes into play. So we've made it clear in our discussions with the advocacy group that we've worked with and other stakeholders in the community that we want to report as much as the data will allow. And we think that's a lot. And I also want to say that we don't think this is the last word in community benefit reporting. We think this is the first word, and it creates a platform that we can build upon in future years and future sessions.
Thank you. Well, and I believe the consistency would be really helpful, and you know, so we can have apples to apples. Final question. On the civil penalties, the reason that you wanted this to land in Uper, because I don't think you have any, do you oppose any civil penalties now? Would it make more sense to be in DHS because they're the ones that certify the hospitals? Or?
Vice Chair Kotek, we do have authority to impose penalties, civil penalties for late submission of their financial data, of hospital financial data.
Already.
So we do have it in that arena. It's a fairly effective tool for getting the data in on time. Makes the trains run on time. I wanted to respond, too, if I could, for a minute, to your question about the looking at this data as a percent of gross patient revenue. That's how we report right now on uncompensated care, charity care, and bad debt from the hospitals in the state. I don't see any reason for that to change. It's just that it would be a much better number because it'll be cost-based. Right now, we report charges as a percent of gross patient revenue. And as we all know, no one pays charges. So,
thank you. Thank you. I'm done.
Is that
okay? Mr. Chair, thank you. And thank you, Mr. Earls. I really appreciate the spirit in which this bill was brought forward and the spirit in which charity care and other community benefits are delivered. I can't help, though, thinking that someone pays for this charity care. We, paying patients, in part, pay for the community benefits that you provide. And I wonder if any thought was given to, or there's any way when you tell the public about charity care to connect it with, you know, where that money comes from. The hospitals don't print money. It would be as if, you know, state government were to say that we provide all these services, including K-12 education and human services and public safety, but we don't charge taxes. You know, they're payers, and I think to help advance the public understanding and advance the reform conversation, it would be very helpful if these were reported in connection with what it means for the people of Oregon. And I wonder if any thought was given. I know this is just taking a little narrow subject, but can you speak to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, I appreciate the question because there are many people who never connect that next dot in the equation, that care that's provided by a hospital for which there's no payment has to be made up somewhere else. And yet, in the current dialogue, I think it's very difficult when you don't have costs from which to talk about that. Because hospital systems are required to use something called a charge master, and they're required to work from a standard set of charges from which they discount. There is a sense that hospital charges are so imprecise and vague that it's hard to have policy discussions from that. So, to your point, this data will really, I think, help sharpen that issue in the public's mind and in policymakers' mind. For instance, there are proposals floating around the building that we should just tax hospitals to expand funding for Medicaid. And we currently, as part of our commitment to the state, pay a tax that we can recover in the form of higher payments so that we're left with the state federal matching fund or the federal matching fund. But there are people who think, well, if you can do that, why not just tax it more? And the conversation gets fuzzy because people don't realize that you can't just print money. You have to shift those costs to other payers in the system. So with a clear data set, I think those conversations become
better.
I don't
see what's so complicated about that. It's very clear. If people don't pay for services, it comes out of the bottom line. If the bottom line gets too skinny, then you raise the charges to somebody else to get the bottom line back where it needs to be. But, some people pay, some people don't pay. When they don't pay, it reduces the bottom line of the institution. And if the bottom line of the institution gets reduced too far, then you charge somebody else who has the ability to pay more. Very simple.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to make a comment on that point. I don't know that it's always that we charge someone else that has the ability to pay more. We charge someone else whom we can charge more to. And I appreciate that also the spirit in which charity care is offered, and we focus a lot on what that means to hospitals. I wish that we spent more time in the conversation about health reform talking about what that means to people who are uninsured, who are not receiving charity care, who are going into bankruptcy because they're paying their hospital debt. I mean, those individuals, when our publicly financed systems are paying at less than 100% of the cost,
and then the charity care is there, those individuals that are paying directly out of pocket and paying their fees are paying it greater than 100%.
I think we will have the opportunity to discuss that with the bill we have coming before us.
And I think that that's an important thing because if you, I just want to say one other thing. When we talk about some of the other things that are available and the idea of kind of protecting the consumer from the market, I think that there are some individuals that are trying to take care of these things on their own who are disadvantaged by not having private insurance. Some individuals with health savings accounts will be subsidizing everybody else in the system. And if people are saving and paying, I don't think that that's fair that individuals are paying more. That really isn't a free market. That market is biased against those individuals, and we need to address that issue.
Anybody that assumes the healthcare market is a free market just isn't watching. It's a very distorted market. There's no question about that.
Well, Mr. Chair, if anyone assumes that we actually have a free market in this country in terms of how we subsidize
anything.
Corporations, I think, you know.
Exactly. Well, I
if
think eBay,
really
right?
Have a philosophical discussion, Mr. Chair. I think
actually eBay is a free market.
Better open it up
right?
for a little longer.
So far, so
good. Let's thank you very much for your testimony.
And Tina.
Tina, have you finished your testimony?
Well, I have just a little tiny bit to say.
Okay, keep going.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to say that the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research is supportive of this bill in general. It's not a perfect bill, but it's a huge step forward in the right direction and getting some consistency in this data. Our office has been, as I said earlier, it's been statutorily responsible for collecting and reporting hospital financial data for all of Oregon's 57 hospitals. For some time now, and we include charity care in that reporting, but it's not well defined, and this is the first step toward getting that defined and the larger issue of community benefits defined. Our office started conversations some time ago with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems about increasing the level of rigor in their reporting, and I think that they've definitely come to the table with this bill and have taken a big step forward for us. So we would like to see the standardization consistency. We believe this also contributes to the Health Policy Commission's goal toward transparency in the healthcare system. People can now look at numbers that are, while they're still not going to be perfect, they'll be more comparable between hospitals that we'd be able to look at. If we write the rules to this, to implement this, the intent of this legislation carefully, collaboratively, and comprehensively, I think that this bill could be a solid step forward.
Can you write the rules without the bill? Could you do this by rule?
Well, I don't have. I might be able to. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question.
Just a quick follow-up. I'm still trying to figure out why this needs to be in statute. I'm trying to figure this out. You want to report about charitable care and community benefit. You're already making reports. You compile the information. You determine what they report. I can't figure out why we need to have a bill to do what it seems like you could request just by making the request.
Why don't you take your time to think? I mean, we're going to come back to this.
I'm struggling a bit with that.
I think it would be very useful if you had that conversation, whether you think you might have the rule authority right now to do what's in this bill. I think it would be very useful for you to let us know that question.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You better just cough or something, huh?
I don't hesitate to speak.
I know you don't.
Thank you. Ms. Edlin, you said that you have been including charity care in your reporting,
right.
But it has not been well defined
right.
And as it is in this bill. So what have you been reporting if it's not well defined? So are they is it useful reporting that you've been doing or just creating work?
Representative Flores, there are accounting guidelines that hospitals have to live by and do live by in general. It's just, I think what really is different between hospitals is who's eligible for what their eligibility standards are for charity care. We don't know. We have this total charge number that we report. We don't have any understanding of how many individuals that represents. Is it
you know, are they paying two large bills or 100 small bills? Some of those kinds of things we'll be able to tease out with this new data reporting. So, no, it's not completely garbage. Part of the problem is that we collect their we collect their audited financial statements. And Charity Care oftentimes doesn't appear in an audited financial statement. It's sometimes in the footnotes because it's not money that comes into the top of the balance sheet, so it doesn't show up anywhere. It's not money that's supposed to come into the system. So sometimes it's in the footnotes. We have a state reporting form that hospitals have to report to us on, but it's not in the audited financial statement. So I think this just puts everything out there. It puts a definition around charity care that where there's not a very good one right now, and makes things more even, more consistent.
I'll be interested in hearing that.
Mm-hmm. Good. Thank you both very much. Can we have Mary Beth Healy and Ellen Tinney, please? And then I think we will also have Sybil Hebb and Marcia Kelly, is that right? For the last panel.
Yes.
The dynamic duo. Let's go. Age before beauty. How are you? What are you? How are you?
And he might be in the chair.
Stop it completely, right?
That's where you want to go.
Let's do it alphabetically.
For the record, my name is Ellen, and I work with the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and I have some testimony I'm going to give, and we are proposing some -1 amendments.
And we have them available for distribution.
Thank you very much. Tracking the value of community benefits Oregon hospitals provide, particularly hospital financial assistance and charity care, is an essential ingredient of understanding costs of caring for the uninsured. Some of you have talked about that already. When we get to a system that will provide universal coverage, we hope to collect that money, that expenditure, and convert it into a system, a more intelligent way of providing health care for people without insurance.
Universal coverage, it's already determined?
Said when? I'm glad to hear that. That was a great idea.
The Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, as Kevin rightly pointed out, worked long and hard with our coalition in efforts to develop legislation we would be willing to co-sponsor. In the end, while we believe this bill with its -2 amendments provide the first opportunity and a critical opportunity to gather data comparable across health systems about the cost-based value of the community benefits Oregon hospitals provide, we don't believe it goes far enough. A recent story is the easiest way to explain why our coalition is asking for amendments to Senate Bill, House Bill 3290. I hadn't seen Jane for a long time, about 25 years. We'd lost touch until last year. Jane is a single mother of a 13-year-old boy who has a history of migraine headaches. Joe had a seizure. She rushed him to the emergency room. She was worried about bills that she knew she would incur and asked questions about programs that might help. She was informed about none of them, neither the Oregon Health Plan nor hospital financial assistance. Jane was referred to another hospital for further tests on Joe. By the time she got to the second hospital, Jane had learned enough to ask about a program she'd recently heard about, the Oregon Health Program, she called it. Staff at the second hospital told her the program was closed, that it was a lousy program anyway and didn't work very well. Jane again asked about programs to help her pay her bill. Hospital staff had said there were none. Jane received a bill from that second hospital within 3 weeks. When she called again to check on whether or not there are any programs to help, no one returned her call. Within 8 weeks, that bill was sent to the Department of Revenue. Here are the problems Jane's story reveals. And some of these problems are addressed by the amendments.
Sorry, sent to the Department of Revenue?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
To attach your tax refund.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Although Jane's income clearly qualified her for the Oregon Health Plan, qualified her son for the Oregon Health Plan, and the Oregon Health Plan is not close to children, she was never offered an application, even though she asked about the program. Neither hospital informed Jane about financial assistance programs, even in the midst of the enormous burden she was asking and even though she asked about them. Had either hospital offered Jane a date-stamped Oregon Health Plan application, her bill would have been paid in full by the Oregon Health Plan, her son's bill. Department of Revenue never checked with Jane either about whether or not she'd been offered financial assistance or the legitimacy of the bill. Finally, after she connected with me, I suggested she call billing and asked if there was some way to work out a lower cost for the bill. And when she called, she was told that by the person in financial, I guess in the financial office, that there were three different ways of pricing the services Joe had received. And they were quite surprised to find that she was charged the highest cost. But by that time, they said it was too late. The bill had already been turned over to the Department of Revenue. Our helpline continues to receive calls from people who clearly qualify for financial assistance, who have never been offered financial assistance, and in some cases already in collections as a result of their hospital bills. Most often when we get those calls, we are successfully able to navigate our callers through the process of getting the forms they need, and often hospitals are willing to pull them back out of collections. But the truth is they shouldn't be calling us in the first place. They should have been offered those financial assistance forms up front. Our proposed amendments to 3290, the -1 amendments, do four things, actually five. They present that Oregon hospitals should have, rather than do have, a strong commitment to the provision of community benefits. They would sharpen the definition of community benefit. You'll see in our -1 amendments between lines 3 and 7, definition of community benefit that advocacy organizations around the country have signed on to, which relate specifically to classifying community benefits as unreimbursed goods and services provided by local health care facilities that are measurable, quantifiable, based on the community's unmet health care needs, and developed and prioritized in an open community-based process. Things like contributions to Rose Festival floats, or in fact a Rose Festival float, I'm not sure that that would be allowed under the definition of community benefit as it exists in your bill now, but we have seen health care institutions in the state refer to Rose Festival floats as a community benefit. We don't believe that those have any place in the definition or reporting of community benefit as we would envision community benefit. We believe that this bill should separate out the receipt of Medicare payments from the provision of community benefit. Clearly, if Oregon hospitals are not getting paid cost for the Medicare they are providing, we should be viewing the underpayment they get from Medicare as a community benefit, a payment less than cost. But we believe that the actual act of accepting Medicare patients is not necessarily a community benefit. Finally, and most importantly, we would ask that hospitals provide demographic information that will allow policymakers and the public to determine the extent to which hospital financial assistance programs actually target those who are most in need. So you'll see on pages 2 and 3 of our proposed amendments a series of questions that would help get at some of the information that Tina Edlund was referring to, things like the total number of charity care applications received, the number approved, the number denied, the income level of the patients who receive both free care and financial assistance. That's the kind of data we would like to see collected that would help all of us working in the public arena, we think, understand two things. Who are the population that's being served by these charity care financial assistance programs, and to what extent is the population that needs those programs not getting the care or the financial assistance they need? Finally, we add in this amendment that the Office of Health Policy and Research should be provided copies of all charity care policies, a description of the availability of the policies at the hospital, and a description of the locations where information about those policies are made available. I think it's important to note that many hospitals do provide financial assistance policies when you ask and you know how to ask, and that many of them do, in fact, have signage indicating that there are places that you can go within the system to get those policies. But we think putting this as a requirement for information to be collected will ensure that all hospitals will rise to that challenge. Thank you for considering the -1 amendments.
Very good. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Representative Greenleaf, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mary Beth Healy. I'm Executive Director of Oregonians for Health Security. And we're here.
We are losing the committee, so we need
yes,
to speed
we are.
Up.
And we're just here in support of the of House Bill 3290, particularly as it relates to the amendments that Ellen just spoke to. And there are people who would really benefit from this. And the lack of consistency, the lack of standards, and the lack of availability of information for people is what is really important, I think, particularly if this bill were to be amended. One woman that I will just bring up was Sue Krieger of Forest Grove. She and her husband lost their health insurance after 30 years. Mike was on the job. And she ended up going to the hospital. She was actually told that she would qualify for the Oregon Health Plan and ended up that she didn't and was never told about any charity care policies that were available at the hospital. Ended up, they felt that they had to, there was a lien put on their house by this particular hospital. They felt they had to sell their home in order to pay this hospital bill. So it is something that directly affects Oregon families, and I have written testimony to talk more about it, but I understand that we are, in the interest of time, I will.
You're distributed. We have
I am.
Testimony.
I will.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Even though the reform committee isn't meeting tonight.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Do we still have Sybil Hebb and Marcia Kelly? We do. Not too leisurely, guys. We'll be here alone with you. We're just me and you.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm on the American Association of University Women of Oregon's Public Policy Committee. And because of the fact that AUW of Oregon has been a member of the Oregon Health Action Campaign and some other reasons, I was invited to a meeting sometime probably 16, 18 months ago to talk about healthcare access and charity care and the access to information. And so I have followed this closely because I've been going to the meetings. And I was in the meetings working with the Hospital Association, and they have come a long way. I think things didn't culminate in time enough for us to maybe hash some of these things out in a work group as much as we could. I would reiterate that I believe that the Dash 2 amendments would strengthen the bill, especially in the ability to know who is actually showing up at the hospital unable to pay for their care. I think it would strengthen
the Dash 1s?
The Dash 1s.
So you said the Dash 2.
Oh, excuse me. The Dash 1s. I do like the fact that the Hospital Association wants some teeth in the bill, and so the Dash 2s are also very good. Let me give you one sharp, quick example. I wanted to know whether this really was a problem. I stopped by a hospital. I presented a scenario about what I would do if I had a situation where I couldn't pay for surgery after having recently been diagnosed and having lost my job and did not have insurance, and I was given a reference to a social service agency in the county. But I was told that if I brought in my insurance policies, they might possibly be able to help if I ended up going there. But this is a better place to go. I think that we need more definition, and I would strongly recommend that you consider the Dash 1s as well as the Dash 2s.
Thank you very much.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Sybil Hebb, and I'm a legislative advocate with the Oregon Law Center, which is a civil legal services provider in the state of Oregon. Our mission is to provide economic and social justice to low-income families in Oregon, and it's from that perspective that I'm here today. Our clients struggle greatly to pay off medical bills. Many of them are uninsured or underinsured, and we hear stories of people who have gotten them into an escalating cycle of debt because of unexpected or uninsured emergency medical expenses. And it's a large source of calls to our office. And so we're concerned about the issue. We really appreciate the attention of the committee and the effort of the Hospital Association, as well as advocates who've worked on this bill to bring this issue forward. And I congratulate the committee, and I'm appreciative of the fact that this is being considered in light of the groundbreaking discussions around the Oregon Health Plan and sort of how, as a state, we're responding to the unmet need as a whole. And they're very much interrelated, so I appreciate that. We're all essential partners here, and it's a good conversation. We think the more specific the standards are, the better, in terms of helping us to identify what the community need is and how we're meeting it. As we work towards that, it may be a longer conversation than this session, but we want to keep that ultimate goal in mind and just recognize that it's part of it, it's sort of an essential information gathering piece in terms of helping us to meet the community need. I know that this has been a long goal, a long-time goal of advocates to bring forward these standards. Appreciate the hospital associations taking a step, and really know that in the end, this is really about meeting the needs and saving the lives and protecting the health of the underinsured in Oregon, and so that's our ultimate goal, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Ms. Pam?
Mr. Chair, quick question. Yes, I'll just ask you, Ms. Hebb, seeing that the Office of Health Policy and Research does gather some information and produce some level of report, is that something that you utilize at the Office of or the Oregon Law Center?
Chair Greenlich and Representative Flores, thank you for the question. I am not as expert on this particular arena as other advocates in my office, but I can tell you that I do know that while we use the information, it's not as helpful to us as the information that I think both the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s contemplate. And again, I'm not an expert on the ways and the methods in which statistics can be gathered, but the more specificity and the more standardization, the better, just in terms of understanding what the need is and what's unmet and what we're doing. So, yes, we do use the information. We appreciate it, but it's not as useful as it could be. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you both. I do want to acknowledge written testimony from Alexandra Bradbury of SEIU Local 49, who supports Bill 3290. I think I read it. Supports 3290 with the Dash 1 amendments. That's the correct reading. Okay. And we have that on the record. Thank you. What I plan to do with this, members of the committee, is to find out for sure if we get a formal fiscal with minimal costs attached. If so, try and get the subsequent Ways and Means referral rescinded. We'll bring this back to the committee to consider. We'll bring it back as a work session. So think about the Dash 1s and the Dash 2s and consider where we want to go with it. I think we'll schedule it as early as next Friday, week from day after tomorrow, if we can get a fiscal before then. So, as they say, talk among yourselves.
Get no quorum.
But don't get a quorum. That's right. I close the public hearing on HB 3290. I thank the people that have worked so hard on this over the past few months. I think this is moving in exactly the right direction. And we'll bring it back a week from Friday. And I close the Healthcare Committee. Thank you very much.